the St. Paul's Carnival this Saturday from midday on BCFM and BBC Radio Bristol.
Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM. 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong. But because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So, Putin used nerve agent to try and kill two alleged hard drug addicts in Amesbury last Saturday. Pull the other one, Sajid Javid. Yes, Putin strikes again in Amesbury. At least that's what we're supposed to believe, with the key witnesses being alleged hard drug addicts. So why did it take 4 days to change from a routine bad batch of hard drugs as the Met's anti-terrorism command took over to an act of international sabotage by Putin? And NATO's biennial summit next week in Brussels. What diplomatic nukes will Donald Trump be dropping? Then we have his visiting the Queen next week, next Friday, in fact. Lots of fun and games on this show, I imagine, commenting on that next week. That's Friday the 13th. Followed on Monday week by the Trump-Putin-Helsinki love-in. All the warmongers, particularly the Israelis and Theresa May's deep state friends, they're dreading that. And carried over from last week, human cattle, the slave trade, Liverpool, Bristol and London pioneered this horrific triangular trade to Africa and the Caribbean, with all the blood carefully washed off the decks before the merchants of death returned to Bristol. But where did we get this business model from? Well, the Italians played a key role, first the Roman Empire and then the shadowy merchants of the Venice city-state. Our sister show Dialects on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk if you like. This week, Bristol's Trident Ploughshares campaign report on their efforts to get the UN vote to ban nuclear weapons implemented. Also, former US Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett's just come back from a briefing from Iranian intelligence. What did they have to say? That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday. You can download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now, if you like. Now, Martin, I guess we have to start, really, don't we, with this incident in Amesbury. What's your thoughts about that? There is some sort of confusion, it seems, about whether this is the same batch of Novichok, if indeed Novichok it is, that caused all the trouble back in May. The only trouble is, of course, that anyone that's a chemical weapons expert will tell you that Novichok only lasts a few days, it decays and it loses its potency, so obviously it can't be that.
It can't be that, because if it was Novichok, they'd all be dead. So that's quite clear. And of course, the timing is very suspicious, because, you know, the World Cup's going very well for the Russians, the English team are into the last eight, and then suddenly we're reminded by how much we hate the Russians. And it just stinks. It's very fishy.
But the anti-terrorism command seem to be absolutely clear about what's caused this.
Well, I think, do you know what? I actually believe that this is probably the most likely explanation of this, is this is a psychological warfare operation by MI6. Operation Beluga, we know that there's a whole program called Operation Beluga, because Paul Burrell, who is a French anti-terrorist officer, gave an interview to the press about 2 years ago, said there's a whole operation called Operation Beluga to prevent a rapprochement between Russia and the West, because the military industrial complex in the West do not want to see peace with Russia, and they're determined to stop it.
And but surely they could be trading with Russia, couldn't they?
Well, in a rational world, we'd be sitting down with the Russians and the Chinese talking about how we could work together to improve the living standards of the whole world population. But you've got to understand that there's powerful forces in the West who do not want that to happen. And they are working pretty hard to prevent it. And the one of the problems you've got is that the mainstream in Britain, for example, and most Western countries cannot get their head around the sheer evil manipulation that their own intelligence services are engaged in. There's a whole, you know, people just lose their marbles when they start talking about it. We had Steve Smith on last week, the Tory chap, and he was, it's got to be secret. It's like, what? Why? You know, we can't really, I don't really want to discuss this. People need to know the history of NATO intelligence services to understand that they are actually terrorists, thugs, and very nasty people.
But I mean, that's how can you justify what you've just said?
Well, in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, there were lots of terrorist attacks. There was Piazza Fontana in 1969, where 9 people were killed by a bomb. The police investigated it all, and Fernando Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who died last year, wrote a book about it all that came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. I don't suppose Theresa May or Boris Johnson have ever read
it. There was also they don't know about this stuff. P2 scandal, wasn't there, in the 80s, which really showed that Italy was, in fact, not being run by the elected politicians. It was being run by a bunch of industrialists, media barons, and Secret Service people.
Yeah, and the Secret Service people were planting bombs and killing people.
Plus bankers. Mm. They were running the country. Mm. It was called P2. And it was Licio Gelli. He was the fascist who was the chairman of the committee.
Well, he was actually a Socialist Party member. But he was a fascist in all but name. But the fact is, it's on the record that NATO intelligence services, including MI6, are terrorists and murderers. There's nothing to dispute there. It's all on the historical record. But you will find mainstream politicians of any party, they just don't know this
so
stuff.
What do you make of our Defence Secretary, Gavin Williams? He's come out with, I've got a clip of him in a minute, actually, coming out with some sort of, it was exactly like Joe Johnson on BBC Question Time a month or so ago, who had something called Siri, which is a little thing on his mobile phone, which tells him things, speaks to him about policy and about various bits of, I mean, it almost seems to me like it's the, let's have a listen to this clip first and then let's just discuss it, because this is not on BBC Question Time, but this is while he was giving a statement to the House of Commons, his mobile phone went off.
In Syria, the Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by coalition air power, are continuing their campaign. This involves the clearance of desert areas, securing the Syria-Iraq border, and rooting out the remaining several hundred terrorists who remain in outposts in the Euphrates Valley and surrounding areas.
I found something on the web for in Syria, Syrian Democratic Forces supported by premonition.
What a very rum business that is.
An intervention. No, but I do apologise for that. It is very rare that you're heckled by your own mobile phone.
Indeed.
On this occasion, it is a new parliamentary convention, without a doubt.
So there he is. It's got something called Siri on his phone, and it is basically effectively telling him what to think. You know what I'm reminded of is the Len Dayton novel Billion Dollar Brain, where various people are given orders by a synthesised voice, which is actually a computer.
Well, leaving aside all of that, when he said the Syrian Democratic Forces are carrying on their campaign, that means terrorism. That means killing people. That means planting bombs. The SAS are in there showing them how to do it, how to plant bombs, how to assassinate people, car bombs, all the rest of it. It's mealy-mouthed rubbish. And in actual fact, our intelligence services and armed forces are terrorist criminals.
So Siri is what it's doing effectively is it's creating a narrative. The idea is that all of the senior government people get this thing that's talking at them all the time, telling them what to think.
Well, he's a young fella, isn't he? A whippersnapper, and he's also threatened to bring down Theresa May unless he gets another $20 billion for the armed forces. It's quite clear who runs this country, and it ain't the elected politicians.
Who is it then?
It's the military-industrial complex and the banks, which we've bailed out for 10 years.
What about this idea that that people in government aren't actually... I mean, this is what it implies to me, this Siri business, is that we're not really getting Gavin Williamson. We're getting is some kind of policy which is remotely contrived.
Well, what I would say about him, he's a non-entity, but he's a spokesperson for the deep state. He's very much their man.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he's not a serious politician in my mind, and we're now pushing to increase. But supposedly there's austerity, and we can't afford libraries or toilets in Bristol. But we're going to have another $20 billion for the armed forces because we're being threatened by the Russians. Absolute nonsense, drivel.
Now you mentioned briefly there some of this skullduggery done by MI6, but it's quite a good time, I think, to remember the fascinating accusation made by Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Mitterrand, that he actually came across to Britain in 2009 when David Miliband was foreign secretary and had a meeting about starting an armed uprising in Syria. Now, the same exact thing happened 2 years later in 2011. That's when the armed uprising began after Gaddafi had been killed. A lot of people then, mercenaries, were brought over from Libya to Syria.
Indeed. And in other words, there's a fairly good prima facie evidence that the British intelligence services started the war in Syria, which has killed nearly a million people, millions of people as refugees and all the rest of it. We did that. And we all want to go out and have a nice cup of tea. Pathetic.
What about Miliband himself, though? Because he went on to run a charity after he left government as foreign secretary.
He did. It's called the International Rescue Committee, and I had to deal with them when I worked in Bosnia. They're basically a CIA front organisation.
Well, okay. What makes you say that?
Because that's what they are.
Just go into some detail, Martin. Well, who are these people, and evidence?
The International Rescue Committee is actually a Jewish organisation that was set up in World War II to rescue refugees and all the rest of it. And it's, you know, the basic goals of the organisation are sound, but I'm afraid a lot of non-governmental organisations are fronts. They're funded by USAID, which is the US government, and they're basically a front for the deep state in the US.
I was away, we managed to miss this story, but the charity was fronted by former Labour Foreign Secretary David Miliband, hushed up 37 allegations of fraud, sex abuse and bribery. Former Labour MP David Miliband joined the International Rescue Committee after quitting politics in 2013. The International Rescue Committee was given £5.4 million in British taxpayers' money. Money given to the charity by the government was then frozen after these allegations. The team was sent to probe claims of wrongdoing in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the IRC. Yet a leaked report from the Department for International Development shows the funding to the charity was cut after direct reporting of fraud and sexual harassment. So is David Miliband a gangster? I mean, what is he?
Well, I think it's quite significant that after having failed in his political career here, he goes to the United States and works for that sort of organisation. I believe he's paid £500,000 a year to work for them. We used to call them Thunderbirds in Bosnia, International Rescue Committee.
The department acted swiftly to ensure the reported misconduct was fully and comprehensively addressed by the IRC and relevant authorities. So he's mentioned by name in the report, and alleged wrongdoing has occurred in this organisation. What they're suggesting here, really, in this report, I'll put a link up to it on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, is that Miliband used his sway with government in order to get money into this organisation, which was then fraudulently sucked out. Effectively, they weren't doing what they said they were supposed to be doing with the money.
Well, also, of course, he pushed at one stage for an intervention in Syria so that we could carry out vaccinations on Syrian children. So the International Rescue Committee, as led by David Miliband, former foreign secretary of this country, was pushing for intervention in Syria. And so that we could go in there and vaccinate the
after
poor children
threats
in Syria.
And threats and legal action, £5.4 million of taxpayers' money was returned from the charity.
Well, as I say, they're funded by the US government and the British government, and they are a front organisation.
I mean, one of the main stories we had last week was the rendition report. That was the Intelligence and Security Committee, and the police are now apparently, and this came out just after our programme last week, are on pressure to investigate. Former military lawyer says the Hague might step in if Britain fails to launch a proper inquiry into the use of torture, because they don't believe that the Intelligence and Security Committee report has gone anywhere near enough to the truth.
Well, there's a whole gulag, a secret gulag out there in which thousands of people are being held, secret prisons. They were in Eastern Europe, Romania, Poland, all over the world. And there's no rule of law. And it's not just that, well, they're overstepping the mark. The intelligence services are orchestrating terrorism, as we know from the Syrian context. At the same time, they're running secret prisons. And, of course, in those secret prisons, people are turned. Yeah? So they say, right, you can go back into the fight in Syria, but you've got to work for us.
Senior Scotland Yard officers are studying a parliamentary report that revealed the true scale of the UK's involvement in torture and rendition. Does that mean that MI5 officers are ever going to get their collars felt, Martin, since the Prime Minister has said that they should not be named and they shouldn't be brought before the Intelligence and Security Committee?
Well, I'm not holding my breath that they're going to have their collars felt, but the principles are quite clear. If you are involved in a government structure that's involved in illegal operations, including torture, then you may think that you're going to retire on a government pension, but it may be that you're not, and you're going to go to prison.
The United States and NATO are establishing terrorist bases in Albania.
Yeah, that's
right. The MKO and the MEK. Right, so hang on a minute. I didn't realise that NATO and the United States actually had their own little pet terrorists, but apparently they do, and they're called MKO and MEK. Who are these people? Why in Albania?
Well, because they were kicked out of Iraq by the government of Iraq, which is aligned with the Iranians, because they're Shia. And they kicked them out, so that they were then moved to Albania, which is actually run by the Kosovo Liberation Army, which is another front organisation. And they're not the only organisation that Western intelligence services fund. They fund ISIS, they fund Al-Qaeda. All of that was set up with our taxes. And it's just going on. It's just people... It's staring people in the face what's actually going on, but nobody wants to talk about it apart from on shows like this.
What about Albania? Why there? It's not very near to Iran, are supposed to be targeting.
Camp Bondsteel in Albania is the biggest US base outside the US, and it's a major drugs transshipment point. They're moving drugs around all the time on military planes. The Kosovo Liberation Army is basically a gangster outfit, and they run Albania. They run Kosovo. Albania is basically a mafia state, and this is the real world we live in. It's all run by gangsters.
Is it Elvar Hoxha? Elmer Hoxha was the
he was the communist dictator, but he's long gone.
Yeah, but give us a little bit of the background on Albania. Well, it's just north of Greece, isn't it?
It is, and obviously the Italians invaded Albania at the beginning of World War II, which then handed their backsides by the Greeks, and then the Germans had to intervene in Yugoslavia, and eventually Albania became...
It's sandwiched between Greece and Yugoslavia.
Yeah, I mean, eventually the Hoxha regime became... absolutely isolated, because they were opposed to the Yugoslavs, who the Yugoslavs were opposed to the Soviets, and they became pro-Chinese. And then when the Chinese moved to the right, they became anti-Chinese. So they really were the only true Maoist state on the planet. And of course, it was a miserable mess. People, I used to work with the Catholic Funds for Overseas Development, people used to go over there. Literally every street corner, they used to have a pillbox. There's just pillboxes all over Albania, which were built during that era. And because, you know, everybody was their enemy. And, of course, what's happened now, of course, is it's been taken over by the Italian mafia.
So this is basically, this isn't actually very near Iran, is it? It's quite away from Iran. That's so it looks as if it's the only place that the Americans could find to put this base.
That's right, because they used to be based in Iraq, but the Iraqi government don't want them there. They've kicked them out, so they've moved into Albania, because that's, you know, they're basically protégés of the Western intelligence.
Is it possible for them to operate from Albania?
Well,
as terrorists to try and destabilise and blow up trains and things in Iran?
Giuliani, there was a big meeting in Paris last week. Giuliani, who's very close to Trump, was there saying
Close to Trump, he's his new lawyer, isn't he? He's his main lawyer now.
Yes, and he said, you're going to be running Iran within 18 months. That's what he said to them, even though they've got no support in Iran whatsoever. But that's where we're going, because our terrorist intelligence services are determined that they're going to overthrow the regime in Iran.
Well, we had a kind of similar thing with Libya and Syria, didn't we? We had these exiled governments that were usually based in London, sometimes in Paris. In this case, it looks like this lot are being told by the West, you're going to be the new government. But, I mean, is there any possibility of regime change in Iran?
The things may change in Iran, but MEK have got no real support on the ground in Iran at all.
But do they need support? What happened in Libya? Actually, Gaddafi had a lot of support, but still things didn't go his way, did they?
No, but they do have it. You know, one of the advantages of having a semi-democracy like you've got in Iran is it's quite difficult. You know, Gaddafi didn't really have a solid base, whereas the regime in Iran, disliked as it is by some, is fairly solid because it keeps asking people, do you want us to carry on? And people go, yes, we do.
So ultimately, what's going to happen, do you think, in order to try and overturn the Iranian government? Because we've had this whole thing of 7 countries in 5 years, haven't we, that Wesley Clark, the American general, said. Most of those have happened. I think it was one was Somalia, Sudan, various countries were going to be on that list. Iran. And they were on that list. We started with Iraq, but the last on the list was Iran. Do you think it's feasible to overthrow the Iranian government and do what the US and NATO want there?
I don't think it is feasible to overthrow the Iranian government. They can make life very difficult for the ordinary people in Iran, and that's what they're determined to do. And of course, the real flashpoint is going to be Syria and probably a war in Lebanon, which will then lead to war with Iran. But in actual fact, of course, it's all nuts, because if there is a serious full-on war with Iran, the Iranians can defend themselves.
But it's not
The Gulf is actually a killing
ground.
It's
not necessarily nuts, is it? Because these people want to take over oil resources and that sort of thing. That's their objective, surely, is they want to control Middle Eastern oil, especially if there are wars and the oil prices go up. That is going to be a massively important strategic resource.
It is, but I think they've not thought this through. Both the Gulf and the Mediterranean are, in fact, killing fields for NATO's navies. You cannot win, but they still the Israelis want a war with Iran. That's what they want. They've made it absolutely clear that's what they want. Do we want one, British people? Do we want to go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy? We need to ask ourselves the question.
Also this week we heard Prime Minister's questions that in Afghanistan, I mean, maybe you could just say what you think about the ceasefire there was for a while last month, Martin, in Afghanistan, because there's been a whole load of Sikhs killed who were standing, one of whom was standing as, I think, a presidential candidate or certainly a political leader candidate in an election there. He was killed too.
Well, I mean, a ceasefire from both sides and negotiation is the way to solve most of these things. And I don't claim to have any special knowledge about what's going on there. But of course, ultimately, the Taliban will have to be allowed to have a say in what goes on in Afghanistan. Of course they will.
So let's go back to Wednesday to Prime Minister's questions to have a listen to this one about Afghanistan and the Sikhs.
Seema Malhotra.
Mr. Speaker, this morning I spoke to the Afghan Sikh community leaders in my constituency following the horrific terrorist attack in the Afghan city of Jalalabad on Sunday, which was a deliberate attack with devastating consequences. The 19 killed included the trustees of the Gurdwara and the only Sikh candidate in the forthcoming elections, Mr. Avtar Singh Khalsa. The Gurdwara had been a safe haven for many persecuted families, and they were on their way to visit the president. Mr. Speaker, at the moment now, the Afghan Sikhs in West London are meeting in prayer and remembrance for those killed, many of whom they knew. Will the Prime Minister update the House on what she is doing to ensure the safety of minorities in Afghanistan, including meeting with the Afghan diaspora about their concerns?
Yeah. What can I say to the Honourable Lady? She's raised a very serious issue, and the terrorist attack that she was referred to was indeed an appalling attack. And as she said, too many were victims and lost their lives as a result of the attack that took place in Afghanistan. And it is important that we ensure that we are providing support, as we do through our contribution to in Afghanistan, which is about contribution to security in the Kabul area, specifically from our forces, but working with others to ensure that the Afghan security forces are able to provide the security and safety for all communities who are living in Afghanistan. There have been tremendous achievements have been made in terms of Afghanistan today compared to what it was like in the past before these efforts were put in. But as she has highlighted, sadly, we still see too many terrorist attacks taking place in Afghanistan, and we will continue to work with our allies and with the Afghan government to prevent these in the future and to ensure that people can go about their daily life in safety and security and confidence.
Well, this ceasefire between the government, Afghanistan, and the Taliban is the first time that something so long has happened. This is it was Eid and Ramadan, the ceasefire. It ended last Saturday, but Martin, is a great piece actually in today's Guardian. Selfies with the Taliban, Afghan women buoyed by ceasefire snaps. When Taliban fighters entered the cities of Afghanistan after hostilities were put on hold for Eid, some women took photos, a symbol of female resistance. The images quickly went viral, apparently. One of the longest wars of our generation took an unexpected turn last month. The Taliban insurgency accepted the government's call for a three-day ceasefire during the Islamic festival.
Well, I mean, obviously, I welcome that. It's, you know, a political solution is better than fighting. But, you know, when people
Can you just tell us a bit about the reason why we're in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, we were in Afghanistan because of Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, which was run by MI6 from home turf here. Lots of people recruited from Libya, for example, funneled through Manchester and into Afghanistan. We were killing Russian soldiers who were trying to bring girls' education, which was obviously wrong. So, you know, we've got to kill their soldiers and drive them out. And that's what we did. And then Al-Qaeda then morphed into what it's now become. And we set it up with our taxes.
What about Syria, though? Because this week we've heard the Syrian government getting rather irritated with the Americans for hanging around because they're starting to do deals with the Kurds.
Well, listen, the Syrian war should have been over 2 years ago, and Assad, who won the democratic election in 2012, I think it was, should be allowed to run the country. But, of course, we're spending our taxes to kill their police officers and etc., so that they can't do what they want. And, of course, one of the things the Syrians could do, I'm not suggesting they will, they should come here and actually assassinate some of our officials. They'd be within their rights to do so.
Why? Of course, no, of course they wouldn't.
No, they would.
Criminal.
They would. No, they would. If we're going to send our special forces into Syria to kill their boys, then you know, it's what the IRA's assault.
But
taking
actually,
the
special forces that are in Syria are simply training their opposition.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
No, they're training the so-called opposition who've got no legitimacy because they didn't win they've got no electoral support. It doesn't matter.
Are you saying that there was a free and fair election in Syria?
No, it wasn't entirely free and fair, but it was more free and fair than the one in Egypt, for example, and we recognised the government of Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood were banned and all their people were killed and they weren't allowed to stand. And they got Sisi got 40% of the electorate to turn out to vote for him. In actual fact, Assad did much better than that. And of course, the reality is that Assad is actually popular in Syria. But we are spending our taxes, sending our boys over there to kill their police officers. Maybe they should send some of their boys over here to kill our police officers. What do you think?
Wandering around the world, we're going to South Korea now. And a South Korean town has called for the withdrawal of the missile defence shield. Now, I suppose this is... is it really a defence shield, this missile defence shield?
No, it has no strategic purpose in terms of deterring the North Koreans, but what it does is it allows the Americans to have a missile force there which can attack China. That's what it's about. It's a way of sticking their finger in China's eye.
Is that if the North Koreans fire one of their nuclear missiles towards America, one of these THAADs, THAAD missiles, will shoot it down. I mean, surely that the Americans are sensible to have those in there.
No. From the point of the North Koreans, that this missile system, if the North Koreans just lob a nuke over the border to South Korea, it won't have any. You know, this won't work to stop that. But what it does do is it allows them to poke a finger in the Chinese government eyes and the eyes of the People's Liberation Army. That's what it's about. And of course, the South Koreans are quite right to say we don't want this here. This doesn't protect us in any way. This is about you having a bloody fight with China.
Pompeo, Secretary of State, is heading over to North Korea. At the same time, the North Koreans are saying, actually, maybe the United States is no longer imperialist. I mean, this sounds amazing talk, really. North Korea has removed references to the United States as imperialists, but continues to speak derogatorily of Japan.
Well, don't forget that the Japanese invaded Korea in 1905 and then put in a brutal occupation regime which ran all the way to 1945. And the Japanese are the traditional enemies of the Koreans. And the Americans and the British who went in there in the 50s just were, you know, basically backing up what previously went on. The South Korean government was put in power in the 1940s, and they were mostly collaborators with the Japanese, and they started killing the left wing in South Korea, and that's why North Korea invaded, to try and stop them massacring the left wing people in the South Korea, and of course the military governments in South Korea were the collaborators who worked for the Japanese. The same thing happened in Vietnam. The collaborators were put in power. The people who collaborated with the Japanese were put in power by the West to try and keep these people down. And most people have no idea of this history. We just go around the world trying to help people, don't we? With the International Rescue Committee.
Iran is warning Trump's oil ban is self-harm. Have they got a point? Because it doesn't seem as if it's a very good idea for the US to be banning the use of Iranian oil.
No, and of course all the other tariffs and things that they're bringing in, I suspect that we're going to have a really big stock market crash.
There is actually
talk,
isn't there, about China and Europe actually getting together to collectively negotiate with each other against the United States with this trade war.
Unfortunately, the Europeans are completely in the pocket of the Americans, and they won't do that. They should do that. We should do that. But
well, that's not what Brussels is saying at all. It's actually it's beating its chest, saying stop, 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 Trump.
Yes, everybody's beating their chest, saying stop, 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 Trump. Especially in the financial markets. If he really wants to go down this road of having trade wars, there is going to be a crash. Of course, there is, and then there's going to be a war. We've already got a war. The crash is coming.
The Trump has also repeatedly been pushing, apparently, for the US to be invading Venezuela. Why is he doing that?
Well, the European Union have refused to accept the Venezuelan presidential election result because the opposition...
That's not all that helpful, is it?
No, it's not very helpful at all. But then, basically, the European Union are... the European Union are basically in the pocket of the Americans. That's the reality.
So they're a bit schizophrenic, really, aren't they? I mean, in some ways they're saying, no, we don't agree with the US. We're having these wars between the Germans, particularly, trade wars, that is, and the US. Volkswagen getting very annoyed with the Americans. But apparently that's not real, is what you seem to be saying.
Well, no, the fact is that what Trump is doing is he's basically banging the table. He's trying to get, you know, the rest
he
of the world...
He was elected to do this, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't elected.
Yes, he was.
He didn't win the popular vote, Tony.
No, okay, so he wasn't elected.
No, he didn't win the popular vote.
That's not the same thing.
In Syria,
he stood on a platform of these tariffs and actually trying to rejuvenate the US industry. That's what people voted for, whether you like it or not. And then he got into power. So there's really no point in you trying to say, well, actually the electoral system is rigged and he hasn't got a mandate. Because he stood on that platform, he's now doing it.
He hasn't got a mandate, a Assad's mandate is solid. The Iranian government's mandate is solid. I mean, Trump's mandate isn't solid. Putin's mandate is solid. Trump's mandate isn't solid.
I know you don't agree with what he's doing, but surely there is a justification if you've been elected to do something.
No, because don't forget, he wasn't... this is actually self-harm. It's what the Chinese have said to them. If you want to go to a trade war, then we're going to go to a trade war. But you will be the losers. You will be the losers. Don't forget that the steel tariffs are actually pushing up the cost for the US car industry, for example. So their cars are going to be less competitive because they've got a steel tariff. And ultimately, this is going to cause a crash.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Let's have a listen now to Anton Chaitkin here talking about the slave trade and why it is that the Bristolian merchants got a lot of their ideas from the city of Venice.
New York State had significant slavery as a colonial state, and I think right even a little bit after the Revolution too. This was Dutch. It was the Dutch influence even after the British were there. Their depot for the slaves was Curaçao. And much of the Caribbean was under this Dutch influence. There was a lot of Jews that had fled from Spain or had been kicked out of Spain and Portugal and had gotten somehow into the Dutch Empire and were in this slave trade. They were carrying out the Kabbalistic religion. But both Holland and England were actually latecomers in this trade. They did not invent the slave trade. The slave trade originates long before there are any blacks in the slave trade. That is, the European trade in slaves starts off with the Roman Empire with various types of large slave operations. And then you have the Venetians, the city of Venice, which is entirely based on occultism and the slave trade, set up by people who were in the slave trade in Rome going to Venice. Venice, Italy, is in many respects the originator of the British Empire. And they're also the originator of many of these concepts of the so-called secret societies. That is, their idea of trade and of business is to have the cheapest possible labor, to have weak governments everywhere, constantly infiltrated by their agents, and to run the world on the basis of banking, secret agreements, and secret government. There's never any constitution or any transparent government. These people in Venice, at a certain point, lost the physical power of their empire, very similar to Britain later on. And so what they did at a certain point was to send Venetian bankers, diplomats, and various types of Venetian agents into Holland and England, and eventually took complete power in those countries, set up companies in Holland and England modeled on what the Venice slave traders did. The East India Company of both England and Holland and the West Indies Company of Holland, slave traders and looters of Asia, which is what had been done by the Venetians, but also the black slave trade, because Venice was the first European power to do that. 5 years after Columbus got here, in 1497, 5 years after he first landed in the Western Hemisphere, Venetian merchants made an official arrangement with the King of Spain to begin sending black slaves from Africa, 5,000 a year, into the New World. So hardly any white people had settled down anywhere. And there, you have to understand why they did that. If you think it's just economics, you are missing the whole point of this. It's like talking about Africa. Well, you know, the colonialists go to Africa in order to steal the raw materials. Well, that may be true, but you could get a lot more raw materials out of there if they had an educated workforce, if they lived in decent houses, if they had an education. Why won't you let them have those things? You could make more money if they did. Well, if they did, they wouldn't need you to run their country. It's power. Power. So the Venetians wanted slavery in the New World because they didn't want the Renaissance here. They didn't want freedom. They didn't want the concept of man's freedom. Because you had another city, Florence. That's the originator of many of our concepts of government. that was opposed to Venice, that said we have a dark world, superstition, epidemics, cities cutting their budgets, running out of money, being looted by bankers, people dying, half the population of Europe, a third of the population of Europe died in one plague. So the people in Florence said, let's not have this Venetian system running the world. Let's look at these little problems as part of a huge problem. And it's not going to be good enough for us to propose a little solution. Issues. Oh, stick to the issues. Stick to the agenda. No, it's not good enough, they said. We need to solve everything all at once. Nothing else will be practical. Nothing else is going to work. This world is too far gone. So they said, let's build up beauty and science and industry and revive ancient learning and invent whole new industries and get the entire planet moving on a human basis. Make maps. One of these maps goes to Columbus. That's their project. And you have an opposite faction, an opposite idea in Venice. And the Venetian idea of slavery, of secret government, of man's degradation, of cults, of the Kabbalah and so forth, that gets into England. They take over Britain, and eventually Britain becomes the capital of the slave trade.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
And that was Anton Chaitkin. He's the son of Jacob Chaitkin, who was the legal representative to the Jewish Boycott Committee of Nazi Germany in America. Fascinating chap. All sorts of interesting stuff, particularly applicable to our city. And anyway, now I hope we're joined on the line by the former Uzbekistan ambassador, Craig Murray. Hi, Craig. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
We've been chatting about this supposed Novichok discovery in Amesbury. First of all, what's your take on it? Because we're told that it can't be the same batch of Novichok, if it is Novichok, because the stuff decays. Well, anyway, what's your take on what's happened in Amesbury and the coverage of it?
Well, I think the entire story gets increasingly unbelievable. I think we should start from, you know, the very basic fact, which doesn't get enough airing, which is that Novichok is not only made in Russia. It was invented in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, in a facility which had over 300 chemicals weapons scientists working in it from all over the former Soviet Union. So there are Ukrainians, Georgians, people like that who know how to make this. Of course, the one of the main guys in the program subsequently went to live in the United States and published a book on Amazon telling you how to make it. And certainly in both the United States and at Porton Down, it has been synthesized for testing purposes. So several states have made it. Iran has made it and reported it, again, for testing purposes and reported the fact to the OPCW properly. So the substance could be made anywhere. And the complete lie that the government keeps saying that only Russia can make it is just absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. And it is a case that it normally is water soluble, in fact, can be washed away. We had the chief medical officer of the UK after the Salisbury attack telling everyone that they just had to wash their clothes and wipe themselves down with wet wipes, and that would destroy any danger, if there were any, on anybody's clothing. And now we're told that magically that's not actually true, and the media have managed to find lots of scientists, or chemical weapons experts, so-called, to come out and say, no, they decided it doesn't degrade after all, and it could stay around in a park for 4 months and still be potent. Which is fascinating. I mean, the way the story keeps changing is fascinating, because we were told that the reason the Skripals weren't killed by this incredibly deadly nerve agent was that it had been on their door handle and it had been raining, so it had lost some efficacy. Well, if, you know, in a few hours on their door handle it lost some efficacy in the rain, I think after 4 months it definitely would have lost efficacy. So the whole thing just doesn't add up. And the story just gets stranger and stranger. And what really interests me about this is, you know, all the evidence from social media and some comments pages of mainstream media newspapers where public are allowed to comment, the overwhelming number of people simply don't buy it anymore. The people are extremely sceptical of the story that's been put out because it's been so full of holes and contradictions from the
start. Now, you've done your own little survey, haven't you, on Twitter? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I did a survey of 200 tweets with the Amesbury hashtag, simply. I just went to 200 tweets and which were just, by the general population, anything that looked like it was from a bot or from an official organisation of any kind, I excluded. But taking 200 ordinary members of the public tweeting with the Amesbury hashtag, I found that 66% of them were expressing, extreme scepticism or disagreement with what the government is saying. 14% of them, 14%, were agreeing with the government that it's Russia and Russia is to blame. And 20% were just commenting on the story without giving any indication whether they agreed or not. But almost 5-1 was the figure, 66-14, was the figure of people agreeing with the government or disagreeing with the government. People overwhelmingly didn't believe it.
So do you feel a bit like a thought criminal?
It is quite interesting. I must say, in expressing skepticism that Putin would have wanted just before the World Cup to get all this bad publicity in order to bump off, an old retired chap who'd already been let out of prison in Russia years ago. I've received a huge amount of abuse online, and especially from mainstream media journalists, interestingly enough. Just asking the questions that outlets like The Guardian and the BBC refuse to ask seems to really upset them. And I don't know whether it's because it provokes their conscience or why it is. But it is very strange. It's as though you're not allowed to question. So questioning is wrong.
The interesting thing is, Craig, I know you visited the place where this Novichok was supposed to be manufactured. So you really are, in a way, someone who's had some privileged inside knowledge about it. Can you just tell us where that was and what the circumstances were?
Yeah, actually not manufactured, but tested. The old Soviet Chemicals Weapons Institute at Nukus in Uzbekistan, when I was ambassador to Uzbekistan, I actually went to a party to celebrate the end of the decommissioning of the plant and it being rendered safe. Now it's quite interesting because the decommissioning was carried out by the United States and by the United States military mostly. And all of the equipment was taken back to the United States. So the Americans certainly have the ability to make Soviet chemical weapons. But also, there were still, there were some of the scientific community from all over the Soviet Union who had been assembled there in the desert at Nukus at the testing facility. Some of them were staying on, and some of them had married locally and that kind of thing. And I was able to learn, for example, that the Ukrainians were a very large community among the scientists making these chemical weapons, the Georgians, various others. So there again, the knowledge of how to make this is not only confined to Russia. And one possibility might be, of course, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying this is what happened. I don't know what happened any more than anybody else knows what happened. And nobody does know what happened except the perpetrators themselves. The British government certainly have no idea what happened. But one definite possibility is that Ukrainians, who could certainly make Novichok, may have done this in order to blame it on the Russians. Ukraine is in a proxy war with Russia, of course, at the moment. And they would certainly like to embarrass Putin just before the World Cup. So there are many possibilities. For the British government to state, as they've repeatedly stated, that only the Russians had the motive, is just absolute nonsense.
Now, I would imagine, as someone who's a former diplomat and also who's had access to this place where the Novichok was tested, that you'd have had quite a lot of invites onto the British media, Craig.
strangely enough, I haven't at all, because And the line I would give is not the government line. I would say it seems very unlikely this is the Russians are doing this. And certainly they don't want to hear that all the other Soviet countries can make it too, and that the Americans took away the equipment. This is all information they're quite keen doesn't get to the British public. And it is actually quite frustrating that, you know, I sit here at home watching the television and I watch people built on as experts who have had a great deal less contact with it and know a great deal less about it than I do, whereas I'm excluded because what I say is not politically acceptable.
Well, here's one of them for you to have a listen to. It's Dr. Sally Leversley, and she was on Channel 4 News this week discussing it. So it'll be interesting to hear what she's got to say and then get your comments afterwards, Craig.
One of the forensic pathways can certainly be that it's been a hostile nation state, and we know that Britain has made a direct accusation to Russia, and that nation state needs to muddy the waters with lots of stories, lots of different counterpoint views, and to particularly take the international pressure off it for sanctions. If it can raise enough questions in international minds and remove the very tight support that there is for Britain over the Skripals case.
But that would suggest that scientifically it may be very, very difficult actually ever to conclude anything from this.
No, I think the scientists will be able to conclude because at the molecular level, they'll be able to see the level of decay. But the important thing is, internationally, has another team come in and done this particularly to protect the reputation of an international state, or has it been a supply chain issue where some medical waste has got into the park and been picked up and reused? We just don't know.
Thank you very, very much indeed for coming in, Dr. Sally Leversley. Thank you.
Sally Leversley there, and I'm also joined on the line by former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who's also, one might say, an expert in this field since he visited the place where the Novichok was tested in Uzbekistan. Now, what do you make of her analysis? What she's saying there, Craig, is that actually it is potentially traceable and linkable back to the previous Novichok attack, the same batch.
Yeah, they should indeed be able to check if it's from the same batch. That's certainly true. The only difficulty is there's no evidence at all that the last batch was made in Russia. So it'll be the same batch, but we don't know where it came from. And I must say, you know, for Dr. Sally Leversley, who's appearing on the media apparently in the guise of some kind of scientist, to then talk about, oh, well, a state might want to attack somebody else as well as a kind of false flag to protect its reputation. Nothing to do with science at all. She has no more idea what she's talking about when it comes to whether Russia would then decide to attack some more random people so it looks like when it wasn't them. No, she's abusing her position. Being some kind of scientist that doesn't make you an expert in international politics and espionage.
Okay, well, I'll tell you who is an expert, and that is the Prime Minister herself, Theresa May, and also Javid, the Home Secretary, had something to say about this attack in Amesbury. I will let you have a final comment after we've heard from them, Craig.
Yep.
The eyes of the world are currently on Russia, not least because of the World Cup. It is now time that the Russian state comes forward and explains exactly what has gone on.
Yeah.
Let me be clear. We do not have a quarrel with the Russian people. Rather, it is the actions of the Russian government that continue to undermine our security and that of the international community. We will stand up to the actions that threaten our security and the security of our partners. It is completely unacceptable for our people to be either deliberate or accidental targets, or for our streets, our parks, our towns to be dumping grounds for poison.
Of course, my thoughts are with the people of Wiltshire, following the fact that we have seen two people this week again affected by this nerve agent. To see two more people exposed to the Novichok in the UK is obviously deeply disturbing, and the police, I know, will be leaving no stone unturned in their investigation in relation to what has happened.
So, Craig, what do you make of that? Also saying that the Russians are using Britain, Sahid Javid, as a dumping ground for poisons.
What I actually found most interesting was Javid was speaking in the Commons there, and when he got to his stirring bit about the Russian state must come out, there were about four Tory MPs saying, he didn't get the sort of enthusiastic applause he was, enthusiastic agreement he was expecting from the Commons, because frankly nobody really believes this.
Okay, what about the targeting in a way though, because obviously one can understand a former Russian spy, but these two people seem to be, you know, down on their luck, and possibly even addicts of hard drugs living in homeless hostels in Amesbury.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big worries about, we don't know who did this. It could have been the Russians, it's certainly possible. But the Russians say it wasn't them, and for Javid to insist on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, no evidence has been adduced that it was the Russians, for Javid to insist that the Russian state admits to something it says it didn't do is a bit daft. One thing that does worry me is when you look at some of the other possibilities for whoever did this, including our own security services, including a rogue person from Portendown. The elephant in the room is Portendown. You know, you have one of the few places in the world that admits it does make chemical weapons, which is Portendown, which makes them for testing purposes, and has certainly synthesized Novichok in the past. And 3 miles one side of it and 6 miles the other side of it, 4 months apart, to chemical weapons poisoning.
Craig Murray, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much for joining us, former ambassador to Uzbekistan. It's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Also, Estella Ticknell in the first hour. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable St Paul's Carnival tomorrow weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
FM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.